TED Audio Collective.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Hi, I'm Debbie Millman. Canva is great for designing visual content for work, no matter what industry or department you work in. Nail your next presentation with Canva Presentations. Start with a professionally designed template and use it as a springboard for your design. It's a serious time saver. Time to present but can't be there in person? Enter Canva Talking Presentations. Record yourself presenting and add your talking head to your slides so your audience can watch your perfected presentation anywhere, anytime. Start designing today at canva.com. Designed for work.
I think that in the other sort of parts of the culture writing space, so music, even film, theater, have been a lot more open to new voices, younger voices, voices of color, than even the art world is today, still right now.
From the TED Audio Collective, this is Design Matters with Debbie Millman. For 18 years, Debbie Millman has been talking with designers and other creative people about what they do, how they got to be who they are, and what they're thinking about and working on. On this episode, curator and art writer Antoine Sargent talks about his career and about the late, great Virgil Abloh.
What he had to do is redesign the world to meet him where he was at.
In recent years, there's been an explosion of interest in art made by Black Americans. At or very near the center of this explosion is Antoine Sargent. He's a writer, an editor, and a curator. He has written for The New York Times, The New Yorker, and Art in America, and his books include The New Black Vanguard, Photography Between Art and Fashion. One of his recent projects is a show featuring the work of the fashion designer Virgil Abloh at the Brooklyn Museum of Art. He's here to talk about that, about contemporary Black photography and art, and about his career as a writer and curator. Antoine Sargent, welcome to Design Matters.
Hey, Debbie, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Antoine, I read that you don't really believe in seasonal style, but you do have one sartorial rule: give a look and always wear a matching hat. So I want to talk about your hats. When did you first start wearing them?
I started first wearing hats maybe 5 or 6 years ago. I started with this wide brim hat, wool hat, black hat from a brand called Westerlin. Then I got a white one from Westerlin, and then I stopped making them. And so I had to sort of figure out something else. And there's a designer, hat designer, who lives in New York, but is from Chicago like I am, named Rodney Patterson, runs a brand called Essential. And he's been making my hats for the last several years. I wear a style that he makes called the Russian cuff hat. It's made actually from this sort of Japanese paper. And so it's actually a paper hat. And so if it rains or whatever, or sweat or whatever, so I get them sort of remade every now and again. And I sort of mostly wear one that's off-white. You know, I slowly started to shape whole entire sort of outfits and my aesthetic around this hat. And so I wear a lot of browns and things that can sort of match the hat. And because it's basically white, it sort of can go, it's versatile, goes with anything. But yeah, I love this hat and I wear it all the time.
You mentioned that it's primarily an off-white hat. Is that a nod to Virgil?
I thought I would use, instead of saying tan or beige, I thought I would use off-white just because of the current show with Virgil. Yeah, that was intentional.
Yeah. good, actually. I was hoping so. And we'll talk a lot more about the show with Virgil in a little bit. You grew up in Cabrini Green Homes in Chicago, and I understand your mom sent you to a Catholic school and managed while working at a Walgreens to what you've referred to as subsidize your youthful ambitions. And I was wondering if you could tell us more about your mom and her influence on you.
Yeah, no, my mother is like so influential in so many different ways. We went to pretty great schools, and it was just, you know, at the time, you know, being a kid, you don't really sort of think about the sort of sacrifice one has to make for that to happen. And so, you know, we went to Catholic schools, you know, most of our lives. I mean, went to Georgetown. So I even completed the circle at a Catholic school. But it was definitely, I think, didn't realize then, but now that, you know, so many sacrifices that particularly my mother made to make sure that, you know, we went to really great schools, got really great educations, but also did the things we wanted to do. And so, like, I somehow became fascinated with German, and in high school was like, I want to go to Germany to, you know, there was a exchange program, and she figured it out, you know, like, and you know, again, when you're a kid, you're sort of in your own little bubble and you don't really sort of know the sacrifices, you know, your parents make, right? And so, and now, and, you know, reflecting on that, I'm like, wow, that was a totally unusual opportunity. Largely because my mother, you know, made the sacrifices on her, you know, salary. I mean, she has moved up, you know, over the years at Walgreens, but the only job my mother's ever had, you know, was at Walgreens. You know, everything from when she was 16, being a cashier, rising up through management, you know. And so it's just sort of an extraordinary thing to sort of think about in relationship to the work that I did do, but also the way that it shaped my life.
I understand that by the time you were 15 years old, you discovered ID Magazine.
Yeah.
And would take a 45-minute bus trip each way every month to get to the one bookstore that sold it. And if it wasn't there, you'd go back the next week to see if it had arrived. You said that you didn't know there were people making the kinds of images you saw at that time in the magazine. Mm-hmm. What kind of images intrigued you the most?
I was sort of just like, I mean, ID was like such a Bible for me. I would go get the magazine, take all the pages out, put them up on my walls, you know, like, and my whole like bedroom was covered in these images from ID. And I think more so than just the type of images, it was really about sort of like the type of people. I just was like, wow, like, who are these people? You know, and I would, and more so the point of who are these people was like, these are my people, you know, like, I don't know where or how, but I know that these are my people. And I just love the way that folks style themselves. I love reading the interviews and just sort of having, cause like, you know, at that time ID was like super young people, right? So like in 15, these folks were maybe 5, 6, 7 years older than me. And so the power, I think, of that magazine really sort of wanted me to sort of be a writer and sort of be someone in the culture. Cause you have like artists, you had musicians, you had, you know, all of these different, you know, sort of folks who were young and had something to say. And, you know, I just considered myself one of them. And yeah, looking at those ID magazines, it so ordered a lot of my decisions in life, I must say.
What's really remarkable to see is when good parenting meets extreme creativity.
Yeah, there was never any, which I really sort of love in what my mother did. I don't remember ever being told, you got to do this or you got to do that. We were very sort of supervised, but also very independent in that sort of supervision. So there was like broad parameters. There was never a curfew, but you also probably knew if you had to school the next day that you weren't going to be out to, you know what I mean? Like, so it was sort of a, it was a really sort of a trusting sort of relationship. I remember I went in the sixth grade, I went to, we had moved away from sort of a downtown neighborhood, the Cabrini sort of old town neighborhood. And the school that I was going to, which was St. Joseph's, which was a private Catholic school that was two blocks away from the building I was born in, essentially, was just like so far from the new neighborhood, right? It was like 45 minutes each way. And my mom was like, the public school is fine in this neighborhood. You're going to go to the public school. And so we went to a public school, and then like, you know, like my Catholic school was so strict that like you couldn't sneeze, you know, it was like, it was a real sort of strict. So then you go to this public school and I'm like, I had so much freedom in the sense that like, if you didn't do your work, there was no like, I don't want to do science, right? Because I didn't like the teacher. I was a pretty, I had a great sort of academic sort of background in that regard. Like I was a straight A student basically my whole life. And I got a D in science because I didn't like the teacher and I refused to do the work. And I remember this was in the sixth grade. And I remember like my mother was just like, okay, great. So you will not be leaving this house until the next report card. And the report cards were like 12 week into, you know, this is not like weeks away. And so she was like sort of tough in those ways where it was like, if you did sort of do something that was sort of beneath what you were capable of, you were definitely disciplined. You know, like you can sort of sometimes push parents to like do, there was none of that in my household. It was like, this is a decision. This is what you're going to do. You will not be leaving the house, you know? And for 12 weeks, I went to school, came home, went to school, came home. And I have learned that lesson well into adulthood.
How did you do on your next report card in science?
Straight A's. Sterling, he's the best student ever. You know, it was like really like.
You know, it's so interesting what people do or how people respond with teachers that they don't like. My nephew is 14 and has been tortured over this last year in ninth grade, hating his math teacher, and was really happy to be able to call her Karen because she felt she was a Karen and that's her name. And the more he hated her, the more he disengaged from the class. And I'm like, no, you can't do this. This is bad for you. You have to win her over. You have to figure out a way so that she doesn't punish you for not liking her.
Right.
And it was a really challenging year. I can't begin to tell you how happy I am that the school year is now over him and he's going into 10th grade with a different teacher. But it's so amazing. It's that like cut off your nose to spite your face when it's only in the grand scheme of things going to hurt you.
Exactly. And you have to learn how to deal with people, right? You have to learn how to deal with people you don't like. You have to sort of, and I think that was probably my mother's sort of point was like, just because I like someone, it cannot throw you off your game, you know? Like, you have to sort of figure out a way around it.
Yeah. You were involved in the slam poetry scene. You were writing. You were also simultaneously interning for judges, doing mock trials, and working for organizations in the community. All at that point with a focus on becoming a lawyer.
Yeah.
What motivated you, given all of your artistic interests, given all of your interests in fashion and style, as well as sports, what motivated you to want to become a lawyer?
I think it was just like, you saw people who like did traditional jobs. You know, I didn't know any artists, right? Although I would hang out at the Art Institute of Chicago. MCA Chicago is a good 7 blocks from my childhood where I grew up. You know, like I went to those places all the time and, you know, and obviously had extraordinary creative friends and like, but I just didn't know like any of that was possible for me, you know, coming from a family that like that you didn't have that representation in my family. You know, like my brother was the first person to go to college. I was the second person to go to college, you know, like that was, and that was in within a few years of each other. Right. And had I known though, that like there was a pathway, say in the arts or literature or whatever, I don't know if I would have gone to Georgetown because when I got there, the first 2 years were literally like, I cannot do this. I cannot do this. I cannot do this, you know, and actually flew home quite a lot because I was in some ways extraordinarily miserable the first 2 years. Like I was like an out gay, like black kid, you know, like, and I had been out and gay forever. And then to go there and then there was like, everyone's in a closet. They dress really differently than I do. They, you know, it was like all of these things that I was just sort of like, wow, like how did I end up here? And it was just mostly because like I had heard that the School of Foreign Service was the school to go if you wanted to go into politics or if you wanted to be a lawyer. And then I end up there and I'm like, oh, wait, I don't know if this fits my personality. Maybe I should have went to a liberal arts school. You know, like that was sort of the first 2 years. And then I sort of met a friend group some were at the school and some were at Howard University. And that is how I sort of navigated.
How did you get the internship with Hillary Clinton?
I just literally applied online. Usually those internships are highly like, you know, it's like you got to know somebody or whatever. I saw the application open. And so I was like, well, maybe I'll just apply and, you know, see. And I got the internship and, you know, was just like on the Hill. And it's kind of funny because that was the moment I was like, I don't think I want to do this, you know?
Yeah.
Not because of anything that happened in the office or any, you know, anything like that. It was just sort of like, I don't think that politics or American politics in this way is for me. Thank you for, you know, that's what happens in internships. You sort of come to realizations. And so, but, you know, there were several times that I met her. At the time, she was like really, I think 3 or 4 days a week, she was on the trail for Obama. But she was there sometimes. And, you know, the only thing I sort of really remember is that she would be there all day long. There was lots of like constituent stuff we had to do for upstate New York farmers. And like, I mean, there was just like it was just really sort of like retail politics. And I was like, I don't want to be involved in this. Thank you for the experience. You know.
After you graduated from Georgetown, rather than go on to law school, you decided to move to New York City and work for Teach for America, teaching kindergarten.
Mm-hmm.
You were teaching kindergarten students how to read.
Yes.
What made you decide to do that? And what made you decide to choose kindergarten?
So, sort of a funny story now that I look back on it. So, all of the people that I know are moving to New York. And so that's sort of how it started. And then I had like, well, how am I going to pay to move to New York? Because it's not cheap. And like, it's not like, you know, there's some family wealth or, you know, anything like that. It was like, you figure it out, you know? And so I applied for 2 jobs. One was at Goldman Sachs and one was with Teach for America, because those were the 2 things that my friends were also doing, right? And so I thought Teach for America was like the better thing to do.
It's like flipping a coin, though, Antoine.
Yeah,
it's
for
like,
sure. I mean,
heads, I go to Goldman Sachs, and tails, I go teach.
The hours are better teaching than they were at Goldman Sachs, and and so I sort of agreed to do Teach for America. But I agreed, and I said I really want to teach history. I want to teach high school history because I can do that in my sleep. And they were like, no, you're needed in East New York, Brooklyn, and you're needed at this new school, and you're going to be a kindergarten teacher. And then I was like, well, kindergarten, oh, they take, like, I remember kindergarten, you take naps half the day, then you go, and so I was like, fine, like, this is cool, like, whatever, like, they'll nap, we'll do the ABC song, it'd be good, you know, like, that was sort of my impression, but education has changed a lot in, you know, in America. And in kindergarten, you expect to read, you expect to do basic math, you expect to, you know, be able to do all these things that you used to have to do in the second and, say, third grade, you know, or the first, second, you know, sort of grade. And so they were like, you're going to be the reading teacher. And I was like, oh, I don't know how to do this, but I'm going to sort of figure it out. And the first year, I had a co-teacher who absolutely hated me, like hated like everything about, because, you know, like it was what I didn't understand then was that it's an extraordinarily altruistic, but in the end, a really sort of insane proposition to send, I guess, highly educated, quote unquote, kids into our most struggling communities who have no education background, by the way, and then say that they're going to transform those communities, right? Like, that was the ethos, right, at the time. And here I come, had gone to Georgetown and DITS and, you know, whatever, you know, and I'm paired with a teacher who had studied education, been teaching for 15 years, had won all these awards, and then suddenly I'm her equal, right?
Yeah, wow.
I mean, I knew nothing about education at that point. I just thought that, like, I wanted to, like, figure out a way to give back because I had been given so much through the education system and given so many opportunities. And not say that I did not sort of rise to the occasion, because I did, and I taught for 4 years, and all of my kids came in, couldn't read, and they sort of left, you know, well above grade like really like reading at second and third grade levels. And it was such a like in every way possible, eye-opening experience for me in terms of just like it really firmed up like what I wanted to do. Because I was like teaching from 7 a.m. I was at a charter school from 7 a.m. to 4 p.m. And then I would get off work. And then, like, I would have all this time, basically. And I'm a person with a lot of energy, have always been a person with a lot of energy. And I was like, okay, like, what, you know, what else? And then, like, I met my best friend and still to this day roommate, Jia Jia Fei, who was at the time at the Guggenheim as the digital person, like, basically bringing the Guggenheim into the 21st century. And she would just, like, she made me her plus one. And so every night I would, like, go to her to, like, all these, like, really great art parties and all this, because I was like in Chicago, this is what I did, you know, like this, I was hanging out with artists and, you know, and so I just sort of start meeting artists and she would take me around and I meet, you know, Kande Wiley and I'd meet Mickling Thomas and I would meet Thelma Golden and I just like meet all these people who I didn't actually could not place really because I didn't, you know, I didn't know the New York art world. I just knew I was meeting these people. They were complimenting my outfits. I was having a great time with them. And then at some point someone's like, well, what do? You're always around. Like you're, you know, you come to all the things like what do? And I was like, well, I'm a teacher actually. And they were like, no, you're an artist. You're an artist. You know, I'm like, no, I'm really a teacher. I just dress insanely, you know, like that's, you know. And so that question sort of inspired, I'm like, well, what can I do in this world, right? In this world that I clearly have a really great affection towards. I like the people, you know, I'm going to people's studios, doing studio visits, seemingly for no reason other than my own curiosity. I was like, is there a contribution I can make here? And at the time, I think it was like, this is 2011, 2012. The art world has changed dramatically in the years in between. And I mean dramatically in the sense at the time there was maybe one or two black art shows every 12 to 16 months, and then we would all have to sort of show up. And so I got to know everybody because there was only so many shows that happened. And there was a far, you know, fewer people interested, even in the black community, in black artists, right? Like, it was like a weird language. Like, what is art? Like, what do you do? You know, my mom, I remember being like, wait, what are you, like, what's going on? What are you writing about? Like, you know, like, didn't you want to be a lawyer? You know, like, those were the sort of the questions. And it was also, I think it was also at the beginning of sort of Instagram. And that also was sort of interesting. So we would just, like, go around. And I would see Jia Jia, like, taking photos of everything. I was like, well, I guess I'll take photos of everything. You know, like, it was just sort of like that sort of how it started. And then Teacher America is a two-year commitment. I had saved up a lot of money. I was like, okay, I'm going to stop this because I have to wake up at 5:45 in the morning every day, get on the C train, go out to East New York. But then I'm partying until like 2 a.m. in the morning. And then, and so I'm like, this maybe is not, like, I have a lot of energy. I don't know if I have this much energy, you know? And then I'm with literally 4 and 5 year olds for 8 hours. I completed the program. It's sort of an odd thing to say. It's like, I think I grew up in that environment over those years. If you can convince a 5 year old to sort of do what you need them to do to meet their goals, then you can talk to anybody. You know, you can talk to anybody. I really,
that's really,
like,
true.
You can literally speak to anybody. And, yeah, you know, at the time, it's like, you know, I'm a little, like, wiped, you know, and because charter schools also go, I think, 11 months out of the year in New York.
And you were also getting your master's degree.
Exactly. And so I was getting a master's while I was doing, it was just, it, I mean, I can't even, I look back at 21, 22, I'm like, how did this, like, how, this was like when New York and New York clubs were still like a thing. And so I was like, you know, and then also in New York, like, Tuesday nights were a big thing. And then it was Wednesday night. So it wasn't even like the weekend, because going out on a weekend was like not cool, you know, then. And so, like, you would just like be going out Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday night. And then I'm like, I have to get up at 5. You know, it was like really, even thinking about it now, I'm like, I don't know how I did that. But yeah, and so I decided to stop after my 2 years were up, saved some money, and was like, well, I'm going to write, because I had gotten some, the Huffington Post had given me a blog at that point, and in those days, those were the coolest things, the Huffington Post blog.
Yeah. You also had an internship at, or no, not an internship, a fellowship.
At BuzzFeed, yeah.
Yeah.
And so I was writing for my Huffington Post blog, and then from that, got a fellowship at BuzzFeed, and I did that for 6 months. Hated every single day of it. Like, in a sense that, like, I was not a pop cult. Like, that sort of thing was just, like, not my thing.
Well, they don't cover art, right? You weren't
exactly.
covering
they
what
right,
you
right.
wanted
they didn't cover
to. Yeah.
Any of my interests, which were right. art and fashion. And they didn't cover, especially in those early days, right? It was, like, cat videos, and they were, like, didn't they
right. have clicks
and all of that stuff. Yeah. And then, like, I was, like, making memes. And, like, a lot of people don't understand that, like, those early day, like, BuzzFeed, like, employees, like, a lot of them have gone on to do extraordinary things, you know, who are extraordinarily talented people. But we're just, you know, we were like, if we wanted to put a, you know, a meme into an article, that didn't exist. So we were cutting the footage, making the meme, overlaying the text. And the, you know what I mean? Like, we were really sort of, and that, you know, it's like tedious if you're doing that for 40 things on a listicle or whatever. And so I was just like, this is not for me. And so I started freelancing on the side. And I would just start pitching things, pitch something to Vogue, and then pitch something to, then there was an editor at the New Yorker who like read something that I did. I'm 23, by the way, you know?
Like, I
this
know.
Is like insane. like 23 year old, like, and then like the new, I started writing for the New Yorker online, and like, and then my beat sort of in the art world was just like, since, you know, all the artists that I know and or mostly that I know and that I hang around with are Black artists, I'm just going to write about them. No one else is doing it, right? And so was just sort of, and so just did that just religiously. And, but I wasn't making enough money doing freelance. I mean, New Yorker online at the time paid like $325, you know, for an yeah. article. And then I was writing for Vice, and Vice paid me a little bit more money, but I had to produce so many stories, right, to sort of make it. And so I called my principal and I said, hey, here's an idea. If you give me back my salary, I'll teach all my classes, but I need to not do any of the other things, right? And he was like, absolutely. And so he gave me back my salary, my benefits, the whole sort of situation, and I taught just my classes. And so I had to be there like, I think at like 8:45 to 1:45. And so in that chunk, I did all my classes, and then I could write and I can sort of do that. And I did that for 2 years before I was like, okay, I think I'm ready to go out and, you know, do this. Meaning I had enough money to make rent. You know, like I figured out enough of a freelance sort of scenario where I could make rent, I can eat, and, you know, there was enough free dinners in the art world that you could, you know, like that was sort of the way that like it was sort of happening. And then people just sort of started to take notice, like artists would be like, Antoine, come write about that. You know, it was like that sort of vibe. And then like the big sort of, the thing that I remember to be like, oh, this, I could really do this was Mnuchin Gallery was doing Ed Clark catalog. And he asked me on really short notice one summer, would I write the catalog? And I was like, yeah, sure. I've never written a book or anything like, you know, or a big essay like this. I'm, you know, just like, absolutely, you know. And then it was also challenging because like Ed Clark was an abstract artist and severely overlooked, but he had been in shows and stuff, but there was not a lot of like scholarship on him. There was no like research essentially, right? And so a lot of it was like talking to his daughter, reading every possible thing that you could find, talking to artists who had like known him or collected the work, talking to his collector. Like it was like this sort of truly like large like research project because I just didn't really know that much about his work. And that was sort of like the challenge. And I remember them being like, well, how much do you want to be paid for this? And I was just like, how much do I want to get? Like, what? Like, I'm usually paid nothing for anything, you know? And so I called some friends and was like, well, what do you, like, when you do this for the gallery and whatever? And they're like, well, you know, somebody told me, like, Ed Clark's work, I forget the price, but it was hundreds of thousands of dollars at that point, you know? And I was like, well, if that's what's happening on one piece of art, then I can, you know, maybe use this to pay off my student loans. And so I looked at my balance, and I think at the time it was like $21,000 something, something like dollars. And I asked him for, I think $22K or something, or like right above that number. And they gave it to me, and I just took the money and I paid off my student loans. And that was the only, sort of debt I had had. And I was like, well, now that I don't have any debt, I can do whatever I want, you know? And so I just like kept writing and freelancing, but it was a lot of like fun though, you know. I was learning something every single day, I was getting to spend time with the most interesting people I had ever met, thinking about questions of identity and race and representation and materiality, like all of these, like just in ways that like artists think in ways that no other humans in any other profession think. And that was just so exciting. I was able to be like endlessly curious and endlessly always just asking questions, you know? And I think that like, being in a world, you know, like that, where it's endlessly creative, has been just so, like, I get up every day and I'm just like, this is so fascinating. And there's no shortage of like artists or, you know, like even like the shows, you know, it's like, I think this year, Virgil is the fourth show I did this year, which is admittedly sort of insane. It's just like, I have so much energy. I work that way because I just have so much energy. But, you know, in those shows, so you have Virgil Abloh, you know, an artist who sort of really sort of did not care about sort of the separation between commerce and art. And then who was, you know, thinking about sort of sneakers as sculptures and think, you know, all, you just have that sort of like part of, you know, an artist who's doing that. Then you have someone like Amanda Williams, you know, Chicago, you know, based, also a Chicago-based artist who also was a trained architect. I was thinking about the similarities between them because both of the shows
actually,
up right
Virgil
now.
Virgil and, yeah,
yeah,
and
like
Amanda,
they're both,
both
from Chicago.
Yeah.
Both trained as architects, both became artists in their own ways, right? But she's sort of expressing that artistry through abstraction, you know, and the way she sort of treats and attacks surfaces. And then before that, you had someone, you know, Awal Arisku, you know, the image maker who made light boxes of, you know, who has a, he grew up in New York, but has an Ethiopian background and is thinking, has totally created his own sort of vernacular, you know, through images. And he made these light boxes of all of these different animals, right? And sort of, it's called Memories of a Lost Sphinx, the show. And he, you know, just like thinking about sort of like the component parts of a sphinx and then doing this installation that he did at our gallery. I was like, I could have never thought of that, you know? Like, and so it's those three different artists, and you have Alexander Smith, you know, the queer Black artist who sort of has just completely created her own sort of universe of characters that sort of center, you know, Black femme identity, you know? And like, it's like, who could do that in the span of 6 months, you know? Like, all of these different artists, really different concerns, and being able to be in conversation with them and to sort of bring their visions to the world in that way really is just like, you know, sign me up. I have two other shows this year, you know?
Hi, I'm Debbie Millman. Canva is great for designing visual content for work, no matter what industry or department you work in. Nail your next presentation with Canva Presentations. Start with a professionally designed template and use it as a springboard for your design. It's a serious time saver. Time to present but can't be there in person? Enter Canva Talking Presentations. Record yourself presenting and add your talking head to your slides so your audience can watch your perfected presentation anywhere, anytime. Start designing today at canva.com. Designed for work.
You're growing a business and you can't afford to slow down. If anything, you could probably use a few more hours in the day. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate, no coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Antoine, you've said that you didn't know you wanted to be a writer until you started writing.
Yeah, exactly.
And you've talked about how, as recently as 10 years ago, really when you started writing professionally, the media landscape was mostly white.
Oh, yeah.
It was almost impossible to get a foot in the door. And there was also no effort to do anything to change the system or the institutions. The people working in it were just trying to preserve the status quo. How different do you think it is now?
I think that in the other sort of parts of the culture writing space, so music, even film, theater, have been a lot more open to new voices, younger voices, voices of color, than even the art world is today, still right now. Meaning that all of the critics that when I was 21, who were the head critics of magazines and whatever, are still in those jobs right now today, 10 years later. At the Times, the New York, any of these places that we sort of go to as papers of record or whatever, there's no consistent black art critic at any of those places. None of those places has a staff critic, not a freelance person who, you know, but a staff critic, right? I don't think there has been one at the New York Times, quite frankly.
I mean, it's astonishing. It's astonishing that this is still something that needs to be discussed, that needs to be pointed out. You know, when you worked on your second book, when you worked on Young, Gifted, and Black, mm-hmm. I read somewhere that somebody asked you, why were you doing a book like this? Mm-hmm. And you replied that you think that the art world has an old way of doing things that excluded a great deal of people, and you're not satisfied with that old way of thinking because it was racist and sexist and got us an art world where 90% of the fucking artists in museums are straight white men.
Yep.
So thank you for saying
that. Still to this day. Yeah. Like, we like to make, and that's the one thing that I think that is still extraordinarily frustrating in this moment, that we are supposed to have all this change, and there's a lot of front-facing of women artists, of black artists, of queer artists, and all of that, but they're not collecting those artists. Still to this day, and with all that has happened and transpired the last several years and the last decade, you still have a extraordinarily reluctant sort of white guard making the decisions. One of the things that motivates me is, you know, not sort of this sense of like the only one or, you know, because like to be clear, I have somehow figured out how to get into these spaces that a lot of folks that look like me are not in, right?
Well, that's why you see it firsthand.
And so, but for me, it's about like opening that, like, it's not even about, it's not even like a savior complex. It's just sort of like, at the end of the day, I would like to sort of show artists of interest, you know, that I find interesting. You know, like, I would like to sort of like, I've spent, you know, last 10 years really sort of thinking sort of extraordinarily critically about black art production. I would like to bring that knowledge to the places that I sort of walk through, right? And I think that for me, that's just it, you know? That it is simple as that. I have spent this amount of time doing this thing, and this thing is valid. Yeah, like, I'm getting a lot of attention, but, like, there are other people who should also be in these spaces. Even in the critical sort of establishment, like, when you have black writers write, you know, in these spaces, it's like they always have to have PhDs. They all, you know, it's like they're almost like have to be like overqualified, you know, not just like this, like I have this interest, you know, even, and I even struggle with that. I remember asking my best friend, Jaja, I was like, do you think I should like go to Yale and get like a PhD in art history or whatever? And this was like 2 years ago. And this is after the New Black Vanguard came out. It's successful in the sense that like an art book does not sell, you know, 25,000 copies in a year or in a half. You know what I mean? Like
not at that price point, not at all.
$50 a book. You know what I mean? Like that just does not happen, right? And so knowing that success and all of this stuff and having the Times clips and the New Yorker clips and having, you know, people, you know, like all of these different things, you know, the fashion company, like all of that stuff. I go, do you think I should go get a PhD? And because in some way I think I felt, you know, inadequate, you know, in some way, like maybe if I had this other thing, maybe I'll be able to, you know, be seen differently. And she just turns to me and she goes, you're doing everything that the PhDs want to be doing, you know?
Yeah, good. Good advice from Jaja. Good advice.
Like, but it's sort of like, you know, even my point in all of that is like, even when you're quote unquote allowed in, it's not going to change if you're not sort of like on a mission to make sure that artists, and it's so layered, like artists and collectors and writers and like are all sharing in that, you know? And so it's not about sort of at the gallery, for example, you know, it's like I'm a director at Gagosian And it's really great. And people made a really big fuss about that. And it's really amazing. And it's a great gallery. And it's a wonderful platform, extraordinary resources. And, you know, Larry is amazing. And like the sort of, you know, the inventor of this sort of modern sort of, you know, gallery system that we're in. And I just was like, well, I can learn a lot from him. And had a lot of conversations about sort of the work that I do and how it's not just about me. It's about sort of like making sure we have on the magazine Black writers, making sure that like we have Black artists, making sure that Black collectors get access, making sure it's like all of these other things, making sure that museums also are a part of the equation, right? And not just sort of wealthy Black or white or whatever collectors, but making sure that there's a public component to this, right? And so every show I have done at the gallery, several of the works have gone into museum collections. It's just an important thing to sort of me, to the artists, to sort of the popular sort of imagination and the public sort of function of those spaces, right? The art world, the art gallery system is largely predicated on sort of the private buying and trading of artworks, right? And for me, as someone who like is sort of in this from a communal standpoint, you know, I love when works go to, you know, museums so that work can be seen by folks who don't have whatever, you know, to sort of have an opportunity to also experience that work. And so that's also very important to me. And so like in the conversations that I have with artists, it's always like, even before we do shows, it's about, so what are the goals here? Like what, and I'll tell you, I'll share my goals, you share your goals, and then we'll work, you know, towards that. And because also, I mean, frankly, you make way less money selling to museums than you do to private people, right? So like, if we say art has this sort of magic thing, that it's something about more than who we are, then you have to be willing to make sure that that work is able to be appreciated by the public.
Working at Gagosian as a director has not hindered you in any way from continuing to do the work you want to do outside of the gallery. And nowhere is that more apparent than in the exhibit you curated that just opened at the Brooklyn Museum titled Virgil Abloh, Figures of Speech. It is a stunning major survey of the work of polymath Virgil Abloh. One of my great, great regrets, Antoine, is that I was invited to interview him by his folks, and we were working out a date in November. Mm-hmm. He was very, very busy, as you can well imagine, and they asked me to do it on the day I was set in stone to interview Ai Weiwei. Mm. And I knew that I couldn't do both in the same day. It wouldn't be fair to either of them. I wouldn't be able to give him the kind of in-depth, robust interview that I would want to do, and felt that it would be disrespectful to Virgil, actually, mm-hmm. and asked if I could have another day. And they said, absolutely, we'll get back to you with a new day. And then he passed away. Mm-hmm. It's one of the great, great regrets now of my career. I'm so happy and honored that I get to talk to you about this show, which I've seen twice and is just stunning. For those that might not be aware, Virgil Abloh was an artist, an architect, a designer, an entrepreneur. He was the artistic director of Louis Vuitton's menswear collection from 2018 to 2021. He was also the CEO of the Milan-based label Off-White, hence our earlier joke about Antoine's hats. He entered the world of fashion with an internship at Fendi in 2009 alongside Kanye West, which kicked off a prolific artistic collaboration. Time magazine named him one of the most 100 most influential people in the world in 2018. And tragically, Virgil passed away from a very rare form of cancer in December of 2021. Did not see the opening of his show now. Antoine, you and Virgil met in 2019 on a call with the Brooklyn Museum's director, Ann Pasternak, who had plans to bring a version of the exhibit to the museum following iterations at MCA Chicago, Atlanta's High Museum, ICA Boston, an exhibit in Cutter's Garage Gallery. What was that first meeting like with the three of you together talking about what was possible for the show?
It was, you know, Anne called me before and said, I have a crazy idea. Would you guest curate our Virgil Abloh show? And this was before, actually, I was even at the gallery, because this show was supposed to open before the pandemic. And I was like, yeah, sure. But first I need to talk to him. I wasn't sort of the type of person to sort of just take a show. I wasn't sort of interested in that. And I was just like, I'm way too young and I have way too many ideas. I'm a black man actually from Chicago. I know who you are. I know the work. I had spent some time at RSVP Gallery, which was like that pop-up shop that he did, inspired in part by Colette. It was in Chicago. And so I had those sort of experiences. And then at MoMA in 2015, during Yoko Ono's exhibition there, she did this sunrise piece. It was at 4 a.m. He played the opening of that piece.
He was a prolific DJ as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He was a prolific DJ. I mean, totally. He played the opening of the piece, and it was 4 a.m. in the morning, and he puts on Kanye West's song that was like, four in the morning, and I'm zoning, you know? And then you have I have video of this still to this day. You have all these kids I had never seen in museums at that point, you know, jumping on MoMA's furniture, like literally just like it's a club in, you know, Berlin or something. I was like, this guy, we need this guy in the art world, because I've never seen kids my age at that point, you know, early, you know, 20s, like this. This is the sort of change we sort of need. And so I had those two experiences, the RSVP Gallery. I knew the work from the Kanye days. And then that MoMA moment, I was like, oh, this is sort of interesting. And then, you know, over the years, he had blown up and has been doing all this stuff and had, you know, moved from architecture to design to fashion to, you know, art to speaker, you name it. He had imprinted himself and his ideas on that sort of creative industry. And I was just sort of more selfishly thinking, man, I really would love to know how he works was the true motivation. It was sort of like, yeah, I'll do the show, like, fine. But what I want to know is how he does this. There's not been a black artist who have worked this way before and has been this prolific in so many different...
It was completely fluid.
Like, creative spaces. And I agree that he operated with such a fluidity. And I just needed to know how that worked, just for my own sort of like black artist, writer, you know, like, and, you know, like, you know, position, you know, in the art world.
So what did you discover? Tell us how he did that.
It was just, so I take the job, and it's like, come with some ideas around the show. You know, my first idea, which we didn't end up doing, which answers your question, I go, how about we just sell everything off the walls for 7 months, just continuously, right? Like, it's art, it's commerce. You don't give a shit about the distinctions. I don't care about the distinctions. The art world pretends to care about the distinctions. Let's just sort of do this thing, but we can also do this thing around consumption. And I was just like throwing these ideas and...
So a cash and carry kind of thing.
Yeah, like the reason why that didn't happen was because one of his collaborators, Takashi Murakami, had set up a Louis Vuitton store at the Brooklyn Museum during his retrospective in 2008. And I was like, oh, it's too close, you know? But he was like, yeah, I'm game. And from there, I was like, oh, we're going to have some fun. We're going to collaborate and we're going to talk. And then he quickly threw me in like six different WhatsApp groups. It was just like curating by WhatsApp is what I call it. That's his mode of communication. I've never exchanged an email with him ever. It was all WhatsApp. And in the main WhatsApp group, it was me, Mahfouz Sultan, the Harvard-trained architect who helped us conceptualize the exhibition, and Virgil. And we just threw ideas all day long. I mean, all day long. We had changed this show 7 or 8 times. He just moved with great fluidity, and it was hard to pin him down because he had so many ideas. And so every meeting, it was like just one idea after next. And you're just like, okay, this is how you're a genius. The creativity was so, like, magnetic and constant and relentless.
You have to print you don't have to. I would love it. I think the world would love it if you printed that whole WhatsApp exchange.
Yeah. You
know, like
he's
a book.
Doing it. I met an editor at the opening who is doing a book similar like this. And so he had already... You know, Virgil was like so ahead of the game. He had already thought through that already. And so he's...
Okay.
And then also there was in his monograph that he published, Four Figures of Speech. And it's unusual in the sense that like it's not sort of a catalog. It's like of an exhibition. It's just like an archive of all of his stuff.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary book. Everything
exactly.
about it, from the spine to the side pages
exactly.
to the end pages to everything about
and
it.
And then his own voice is in it, but it's his whole
yeah.
archive. And so in that archive, you have all of his, like these WhatsApp exchanges, just sort of like, and so because that was, I mean, he would draw literally right onto things in the WhatsApp. He just sort of moved in a super fluid way, and that was a way for him to be able to be a part of as many conversations as he possibly can, because then I met people, and they're like, I was in 15 WhatsApp chats with Virgil. And then, like, you would go to his studio in Paris, and I remember being there in February, right before the shutdown, and I walk in, and, like, Tekashi Murakami is in one corner, you know, there are some rappers in this other corner, there's Mafuz, there's Oana, there's just, like, all of these people who seemingly come from all of these different worlds, and not to mention the vast majority of the staff that were working for him were these black kids that he had seemingly met around the world and on Instagram. You know, it's like one guy was from, he liked the way he was dressed on Instagram, lived in Harlem. He was like 17. And he was like, do you want to come style the show? And so he flew into Paris to style the show. And he's to see this kid on Instagram. Another kid was like from like, I think, Sudan. Tawanda, who runs his design studio today, Alaska, guessed his email address and emailed him and said, I want to work for you. Now he's the head of his design studio.
Yeah.
And the first project they worked on is the IKEA collaboration.
Yeah.
You know, like, so I needed to see that. Like, I needed to, because it really offers a real way that artists could be in the world. You know, as a curator and as a writer, one thing that I do is often sort of share knowledges, right? From artist to artist, or in a museum, or in a gallery, or in a book, or whatever. And I just wanted to have the opportunity, selfishly, totally, admittedly selfishly, to be able to share that knowledge, to sort of share the way that Virgil Abloh worked as an artist, right? Because I think there is something in the sharing of his practice that others can learn from, right? Maybe that goes back to the teaching, but I take that really to heart when I'm doing any of the creative work, is to make sure that, like, there are ways for folks to take something from it. And so at the Brooke Museum, what you see is really an artist's journey from beginning, really, like, early ideas to being on the world stage. And you know, one of the things I remember, you know, asking him was, like, you make things in funny materials, is what I think I said, or something. And he just told me, serious as he always was, it's about the materiality, what I'm trying to communicate. When you see the foam, when you see the paperclip jewelry and all of these things, is what I'm trying to communicate is that you can be creative, and it's in your vicinity to be creative. And so when I was a kid and I took the paperclips and I made the necklace, that was me using the materials around me. And so when I build a city out of styrofoam, like he did with Chicago, and it opens the exhibition, what he's saying is you can go to Home Depot, or you can go to an Ace Hardware, or you can go to a hardware shop, and you can get some foam and you can build some shit too. You know, he had such a democratic spirit, you know, like in that way. That is sort of what I want more than anything for the public to sort of understand, is the way in which he operated, because a lot of times what you saw was the final product, right? You saw a sneaker, you saw a runway collection, you saw a speaker system, you know, you saw the end product, right? And I think that what this show allows is for the accessing of his prototypes, and how those prototypes led from one idea to the next. It might have shown up, say, as a chair that then influenced a jacket, right? Like, I wanted to show the fluidity, but I wanted to, he used to always say that everything's a prototype. And so what he meant by that was, like, one idea leads to the next, and he's never finished with an idea. And boy, was he never finished with an idea. I mean, sometimes I must say, like, it was extraordinarily frustrating to be like, but we just
We settled on this show. Like, we have a show. Here's the floor plan. This is the pathways through. We have these beautiful sight lines. Like, this work speaks to that work. Like, it's good. We are great. Like, let's, you know, we worked down to the wire, you know, on this exhibition. And it's generally not the way that museums work. Like, usually museum exhibitions are set long in advance. I mean, we were moving things until the day before. I mean, we had the show notes that guide you through. I mean, we had to totally redo those the day before. And thank God, I mean, thank God for Anne and Brooklyn Museum, the Brooklyn Museum team, because I don't know another museum on this planet that would have allowed an artist to change things that they had signed off on, was set in stone. Even a social sculpture, you know, the sort of middle sort of piece in the exhibition. Can we see some plans? Can we see some plans? Like, how are you going to build a large scale house in a museum? It takes some time, you know? I think we got the plans 3 months ago, like 3 months from the day that we're sitting here having this conversation.
Wow. The show opened like 3 days ago.
And so I was just like, we have a wood shortage. This is not possible, you know? And what I loved about Virgil and what I love about his wife and his team is that they so believed in his ideas that they were willing to do whatever it took. So once you settled on an idea, it was like, we are getting this made, you know? And it was a gazillion dollars, and we did it in New Jersey. I mean, I had several meltdowns, you know, but they got it done. We got it done. And, you know, it becomes his last architectural sort of project as a living artist. And it's just so special to have that work because it really is about the two things that Virgil, I think, at his core as an artist were about, which is community and collaboration. And so, yes, he was an architect in fashion, in design, in all of the spaces that he moved through. He kept sort of the central sort of tenet of what architecture is, which is to create space, right? And so he created space, literal space, but he also created spaces for collaborators and friends and for people he didn't even know, right? And in the space of the social sculpture, he was like, I want kids to come and take the space. I want artists to come take the space. I want my collaborators to come teach classes and all. And so that's what's happening in that space, you know? It's a space that through collaboration and creativity, he helps sparks other ideas for other people then to go on and do other things, right? And so it's a real sort of living sculpture in that way. And that, for me, I think, out of all the works of art in the exhibition, that one, I think, speaks the most clearly to Virgil's ethos.
He said over and over again that everything that he did was for the 17-year-old version of himself. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, I think that helps us understand how he's going to live forever.
Yeah, no, I think about that quote a lot. And I think about that in relationship to sort of like what he meant, right? Like, this was a 6'4". Dark skin, black man, right? Like the world was literally not built for him. Like literally, like physically his body. And so what he had to do is redesign the world to meet him where he was at. When you talk about the 17-year-old self quote, or the I sell ideas, you know, like those sort of quotes or the albalisms, right? Like you think about what he was trying to do, not only with objects, but also with language, right? He had a language, he had names for everything, and he had ways that he thought about it, and he had principles and all these things. What he was trying to do was construct a new way of being, of seeing. It was just like one that was extraordinarily considerate, right? Like the Nike shoes, you know, he dressed the guards, right? Like, and in the show, right? And so the Nike
swanky sneakers.
And he did the whole uniform. And yeah. But the Nike sneakers have garnered a lot of attention because they're unreleased. What a gesture, right? For like the people in museums who are often overlooked and undervalued to sort of be the first folks to wear those sneakers, right? As Virgil intended, it's about sort of like, which I think he did a lot, was sort of trying to sort of transfer value, to confer value onto those who had been all but rendered valueless in the systems in which they operate, in the cultures in which they operate, right? And that's why when he writes sculpture on a handbag, it's about sort of not just like
being funny or ironic or Duchampian or, you know, Hamian. It was about sort of making sure that folks who prize, say, their handbags or something else as a sculpture were taken as seriously as, you know, sculptures on a plinth in a museum, you know? And so yeah. It was about sort of trying to make sure that the people where he came from that he knew mattered as much as, like, the things that we regard as high culture or whatever.
Absolutely. My favorite, one of the my favorite things that I own is his IKEA clock that says temporary.
Temporary, yeah. Yeah.
Because, you know, what is time?
Yeah.
Right? Antoine Sargent, thank you, thank you, thank you so much for joining me today and talking about so much work you do that matters. Thank you for joining me today on Design Matters.
Thanks for having me. This was such a, it was like such an amazing conversation. I really appreciate it.
You can find out more about Antoine Sargent at antoinesargent.com. That's AntouanSargent.com. And you can see the show that we've been just talking about that he curated for the Brooklyn Museum titled Virgil Abloh, Figures of Speech through January 2023. But go soon. It's an amazing experience. This is the 18th year we've been podcasting Design Matters, and I'd like to thank you for listening. And remember, we can talk about making a difference, we can make a difference, or we can do both. I'm Debbie Millman, and I look forward to talking with you again soon.
Design Matters is produced for the TED Audio Collective by Curtis Fox Productions. The interviews are usually recorded at the School of Visual Arts in New York City, the first and longest-running branding program in the world. The editor-in-chief of Design Matters Media is Emily Weiland.